arguing for the petitioner, Keisha Nakamura, arguing for the respondent, Brian Vincent, argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? Okay, and my understanding of Ms. Nakamura, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on with 10 minutes to go, and Mr. Vincent will give you a five-minute warning before the end of your time to argue. Ms. Nakamura, if you'd like to proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Tricia Nakamura on behalf of Petitioner Brandy Ivalani-Ciavilla.
And you may want to just pull the microphone. There you go.
Thank you. At this time, we thank the court for accepting Ms. Avila's application for writ of certiorari to review the Intermediate Court of Appeals order filed on April 9, 2012. We raised two issues in her application. First, whether the ICA gravely erred in concluding that the district court's error in admitting the results of Ms. Avila's HGN test was harmless. And two, whether the ICA's order affirming Avila's conviction constitutes an obvious inconsistency with His Honorable Court's recent decision in State versus Nesmith. Starting with the first issue of the HGN test, this court must hold that the district court's error in admitting the results of the HGN test was harmless and therefore remand the case. The ICA was correct in holding that the admission of the HGN test results was error because there lacked proper foundation. The issue then becomes whether such error was harmless. It was not. The standard here from State versus Aplaca is whether there is a possibility, just the mere possibility, that the error might have contributed to the conviction. And where there is a wealth of overwhelming and compelling evidence tending to show that the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, errors in the admission of the evidence are deemed harmless. Here, there was a mere possibility that the error contributed to Ms. Avila's conviction. The circuit court itself incorporated the HGN test results in its findings, and the ICA gave significant weight to the HGN test results and discussed it at length. In this case, the evidence is not overwhelming or compelling to show Ms. Avila's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, the evidence shows that Ms. Avila herself was able to care for herself and guard against casualty. Briefly reviewing the facts, if I may, the officer claimed Ms. Avila was speeding, yet there's no record of the rate at which she was traveling. There was no citation issued. She did cross train tracks on a curb, yet she was in an SUV and safely pulled over to an area of the road that was paved rather than rocky in order to protect herself and take her vehicle out of the passageway. She did have red and watery eyes. It was about 3:30 in the morning, which could explain that. She did smell of alcohol, yet it was not adduced at trial whether she had been drinking. The officer claimed Ms. Avila was verbally aggressive and uncooperative. Well, let's return to the facts. It was 3:30 in the morning. Ms. Avila was being questioned by a police officer, and she needed to use the restroom. In addition, she was swaying during the HGN test. However, the officer himself acknowledged that the road might have had debris on it, and Ms. Avila was wearing high-heeled shoes. All of this evidence, even viewed in a light most favorable to the state, are not compelling or overwhelming to sustain Ms. Avila's conviction. Let's take the next issue, the issue one regarding the obvious inconsistency with your holding in State versus Nesmith. Here, the complaint was fatally defective. Ms. Avila was charged with OVUII A1, and in Nesmith, you concluded that the ICA erred by holding that mens rea need not be alleged in an HRS 291E61A1 charge, as without such an allegation, the complaint fails to fully define the offense in unmistakable terms readily comprehensible to persons of common understanding.
Counsel, the issue, though, was that there was no objection below, although there was in Nesmith, there was no objection below here. So the question is whether the court can even reach that argument. Now, I gather that you are arguing that the issue is jurisdictional. Could you explain to the court what you mean when you characterize the argument as jurisdictional?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. We do believe, I think there was maybe two questions in that question, and I'll answer. Well,
there probably were three of them, but go ahead.
I'll answer first by discussing the jurisdictional issue. We do believe that there was no jurisdiction in this case. The decision in Nesmith did not need to read the question of jurisdiction. It was decided on notice grounds and due process. However, here, We look at jurisdiction because Nesmith did reference State versus Cummings and State versus Walker.
You would agree Nesmith was not decided on jurisdictional grounds, then? Is that
correct?
What I...
That was noted on notice and due process issues. And, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting is the state does reference that ICA decision in Shenguya. And, you know, that obviously is not binding on this court. In addition, our belief is that perhaps the ICA interpreted wrongly and perhaps misapplied, with all due respect, Justice Okoba's reference to the majority opinion. There it's very clear that the majority did not discuss jurisdiction, it discussed notice. Here, however, we're arguing that the notice issue does raise the issue of jurisdiction. Going back to State versus Walker, Walker stated that a criminal charge has two functions. First, the charge must sufficiently allege an offense to properly confer jurisdiction, and two, it must inform the defendant of the nature and cause of the accusation.
But Walker was not a state of mind case, was it? Walker was a case involving whether the conduct had taken place on a public roadway, which
That's
this
correct.
Court had said was an element of the offense. Is that correct?
That's correct. The issue in Walker was whether the definition of habitual was clear to the defendant to give notice. However, in addition to Walker, Nesmith does reference State v. Cummings, and in State v. Cummings, there was discussion about jurisdiction and whether the charge included material elements necessary for
well,
the complaint.
You know, I can come back to the prosecution's reference to the concurring and dissenting in Nesmith, but I wanted to solidify one thing first, that Nesmith didn't say with respect to 291E 61A1, the specific charge in this case also, expressly that it was, that it necessarily had to decide the jurisdiction issue, right? Because it found the defendants guilty on the A3 charge.
That's
and
right.
So didn't necessarily, and apparently did not, decide the A1 charge. Except it was very specific because Nesmith said, and I'm quoting, in short, mens rea must be alleged in an HRS 291E 61A1 charge. Now, is there any ambiguity in that statement?
There is not, Your Honor.
So I would take it from the majority opinion in Nesmith that from now on, or at least from the time of Nesmith, that the prosecution must allege the mens rea in an A1 charge. And was that done in this case?
That was not done. And I do acknowledge that Ms. Avila did not raise this at trial, nor in her opening brief. At the time, this did not appear to be an issue. However, we feel that it's possible to bring this up now, and in fact, it must be brought up now in order for justice.
Okay. And then Smith also said, just prior or somewhat prior to the statement I just read, which is a conclusion of a discussion, Nesmith embarks on, after saying that a state of mind is not an element under 702.205, because a state of mind is not listed as an element in that section, the majority goes on to say, well, but it's still an essential fact that must be alleged, which is, I think, where my statement about what the majority was saying was taken out of context in Shenguya. I'll come back to that. And so just reading from Nesmith, it says, the conclusion, that is, that element is not listed in 702.205, does not end our inquiry, however, in resolving the issue of whether mens rea must nonetheless be alleged in an HRS 291E 61A1 charge, we note that we have previously held that failure to allege more than just essential elements can be fatal to a charge. And see, for example, Territory v. Goto, Peter's J. Concurring, failure of an indictment to state facts sufficient to constitute an offense against the law is jurisdictional. So, at least the majority there said, although state of mind is not an element, it is an essential fact, in essence, and that it relied on prior case law that said the failure to cite an essential fact is jurisdictional. Now, in this case, is state of mind an essential fact?
We believe it is.
And was it alleged?
It was not alleged in the complaint.
So based on our prior case law, is that a defect in jurisdiction?
I do believe so, Your Honor. It is extremely important to allege all of the essential facts and all of the parts of the complaint properly. In this case, Ms. Avila was not necessarily prejudiced because she wasn't on notice. And I've been reviewing this conversation in my mind about whether Ms. Avila was indeed prejudiced, because she did have counsel at the time. She was represented by the public defender's office. But I'm in district court, and I see a lot of people pro se. And if the complaint isn't proper and doesn't allege essential facts or the mens rea, all the necessary elements, people are at a real disadvantage. Even when they are represented, they're at a disadvantage, because at every point they're making decisions with.
You know, it always bothers me that in every case, every other crime, there's no problem in designating the mens rea. We do it for every defendant, except for the defendants who are charged under crimes that don't expressly list a mens rea, although there is 702-206 that says, hey, or if we don't, if the statute doesn't list a state of mind, then the state of mind is intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. So what's the problem in saying for those defendants who are charged under offenses that don't expressly set out a state of mind, in setting out the state of mind that is under the statute incorporated into those offenses by the provision that says, hey, if the offense doesn't say the state of mind, these are the three states of mind. Aren't all defendants entitled to be told what the state of mind is?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. The complaint normally does.
So what's the problem, and then why isn't it done? And why do we have such a problem in saying it should or should not be done?
With all due respect regarding the charging, we'd have to ask Mr. Prosecutor here to my side. I'm not sure why it's not done, and I do believe it does need to be done. Going back to what I was saying about district court, it is bothersome to me. It is troubling that different defendants are not on notice as to what they're fully being charged of. One cannot expect a person normally, even folks with counsel, they do look up the statutes themselves, and they have questions that stem from that. And if there's no reference to the state of mind, general intent requirement, or the intentionally knowingly or recklessly, they're not on notice of such. Therefore, they are prejudiced.
Counsel, just to be sure that we understand the implications of your argument, if I understood the briefing, your position is that if state of mind isn't alleged, there's no jurisdiction, therefore the prosecution is a nullity. Is that correct?
Yes, because subject matter jurisdiction is not in conflict.
Okay, so it's not it's not waivable because it goes to the jurisdiction of the court. It's not subject to a harmless error analysis. Would you agree with that as well?
That's correct. Because there's no subject matter jurisdiction, the case must be dismissed.
And could it be raised on collateral review? In other words, could every DUI conviction in the state that ever occurred in which there was not an element of intent alleged, could that not be challenged on collateral review? Because all of those would be a nullity under your position.
Well, we'd hold that from the point at which Nesmith was decided that it would move on from there.
Why would that be? If they're nullities, they're nullities.
That would be.
Would that not be the implication of your argument?
That would be the implication.
One of the implications.
So then this case is not post-Nesmith?
This decision, when I looked at the timeline of this.
The facts of this case.
That's correct.
So I want to make sure that I understand. You are arguing that if Nesmith applies, there's no jurisdiction, and the case must be remanded and for dismissal at district court. However, you're also arguing that if the HDN test was and there was lack of foundation, you are arguing for a reversal of the conviction.
I believe that the conviction would need to be vacated.
And
remanded.
And remanded.
Correct.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. So if I can return to the reason we, I know that timing is an issue perhaps in this case. However, State versus Gendris does state that the requirement to state an offense may not be waived or dispensed with, and the defect is ground for reversal, even when raised for the first time on appeal. And therefore, the court must look at the Model Wells liberal construction analysis. Here, I've argued shortly that Ms. Avila may not have necessarily been prejudiced, but however, in a global scheme, defendants will be prejudiced if the mens rea is not alleged. Second, the complaint here cannot be construed to charge a crime, as I've reviewed pursuant to Nesmith. So we respectfully request that this court vacate Ms. Avila's conviction and dismiss the case. And if I
well,
can
even in Nesmith, are you finished?
I'm happy to answer questions, Justice Sokoba.
Well, even in Nesmith, Nesmith referred to Elliott.
Yes.
You recall that? In fact, it cites Elliott just before the statement that I read to you. In short, mens rea must be alleged in a 61A1 charge. Elliott was a challenge to jurisdiction after the trial, right?
That's correct.
So in Elliott, MOTA was applied. Mm-hmm. And MOTA would have to be applied in your case also because this challenge is raised after trial. Is that right?
That is correct.
And Nesmith quotes Elliott, agreeing with it, because it quotes Elliott and saying that even under a liberal review, we held that a charge could not reasonably construed to the state the offense of resisting arrest. And this court held the requisite state of mind was omitted from the charge. Is that the case in your case?
That's correct.
And we perceive no way in which we could reasonably construe it to charge resisting arrest or any included offense. So doesn't that mean that even in MOTA cases under Nesmith, that if you fail to allege the state of mind, there can be no reasonable construction of an offense? Because an offense, by necessity, needs a state of mind. If you don't have a state of mind, how can you reasonably construe an offense?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So does this apply to your case, too?
It does, and it was very illuminating to read the Elliott decision in light of Nesmith, simply because Elliott, there were three reasons that the issue didn't state a crime, and one of those was the lack of mens rea. So we argue that's the same in this case.
So would the Model Wells rule be gone if we adopt your approach here? And there's also another line of cases called Treat and Spratling, where if there were reference to the evidence that comes in a trial is appropriate, but that would not be valid either, presumably, if the thing was a nullity, the case was a nullity from the start. So would those two lines of doctrine no longer be viable if we adopt the suggestion or the approach that you're suggesting?
I don't believe so. I believe the Model Wells analysis, even if it, would still stand even in this situation, because reading the Elliott case alongside Nesmith, the issue there was one. The issue is one of mens rea. There can be other areas, perhaps ones that I can't think of right now, that in which the charge would not stand the Model Wells construction test, but that would be the starting point.
What about Treat and Spratling? Why would we look at evidence that came in a trial? Why would that be relevant to deciding whether the defendant had adequate notice?
I think notice is something that is extremely important and needs to be protected. So those, I believe the Spratling issue would still come into play. Because
are you familiar with the facts of Treat and Spratling?
Not off the top of my head. Justice.
Well, Stratling had to do with bodily injury, right? Wasn't that the problem in that case? And I think the majority said, hey, you know, injury, you would infer. I could be wrong. I haven't read it in a long time. Injury, you could infer, must mean bodily. So the fact that bodily was not alleged, was not, didn't make the charge insufficient or defective.
Yes.
I may be wrong. But
and Treat actually dealt with this court said that we must consider all of the information that was provided. And actually, what was considered in Treat was actually the grand jury testimony, was it not, in construing the indictment as to the sufficiency of the indictment? And it wasn't actually a trial testimony as compared to Spratton's?
I'm not familiar with Treat. I actually am sort of vaguely familiar with Spratling in my review regarding the bodily injury. And in that instance, I think that was a little bit different, and because it dealt with the language of the case and the court ruled on the statutory grounds, whether the charge itself failed to provide notice based on the reference in the complaint or the charging documents of the statute. But I know that I need to reserve some time for rebuttal, so if I may.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Vincent?
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent on behalf of the State of Hawaii. May it please the Court.
Excuse me, Mr. Vincent, so I don't lose my train of thought. So if you don't allege mens rea in a complaint, your position is it's nevertheless sufficient and not defective?
It can be reasonably construed to charge a crime.
And in this particular case, how could it be reasonably construed?
Because just from common sense.
Common sense?
Okay.
And under common sense, what state of mind would apply?
Intentionally knowing or recklessly.
And the person on the street would know it must be one of those four?
Person on the street, whether or not the person on the street.
Sorry, not one of those three, because there is potentially at least a fourth one,
whether
negligently.
Not, whether or not the person on the street would know whether what the requisite state of mind would go to the constitutional fair notice aspect of the charge, okay?
And if there's no fair notice, is the complaint subject to or indictment subject to dismissal?
We believe that if it's a constitutional error, it should be treated like every other constitutional error and subject to plain error or harmless error analysis.
Assuming no plain error or harmless error, you just got the indictment. It doesn't inform you. You move to dismiss. Defense moves to dismiss. Should that be granted?
If it's moved, if the defendant moves to dismiss before trial, Nesmith and Castro, I believe, say that it's got to be dismissed. There's an automatic vacational rule, from what I understand, from Nesmith and Castro.
And why must it be dismissed?
We believe that it must be dismissed because we believe one of the rationales for when it's objected to before the trial is to encourage defendants to object to charging errors before trial.
Could one reason also be that it's dismissed because it fails to provide the defendant with necessary information?
Not if the defendant has a competent attorney.
Not if, so the attorney would know.
Attorney would know.
Okay, but assuming, whether or not the attorney knows, isn't the defendant entitled to be informed of what the state is charging?
And a competent attorney would discuss all the defenses.
Okay, that wasn't my question. My question was, isn't the defendant entitled to know that what the state is charging?
We're not disagreeing with Nesmith at all, okay?
Just answer my question if you don't mind. Is a person entitled to know what the state is charging?
He's entitled to know that, and it's subject to plain error.
And if the person isn't informed of what the state is charging, then is the complaint sufficient or the charge sufficient?
It's not sufficient for constitutional purposes.
And if not sufficient, is it subject to dismissal?
It's subject to dismissal if it's objected to before trial.
So what do you make of the statement in Nesmith that says, in short, mens rea must be alleged in a 61A1 charge?
It means that it must be in the charge. Post-Nesmith, we are putting it in every charge.
And what about this case?
In this case was pre-Nesmith, but unlike in Nesmith, the defendant did not object before trial. In fact, he didn't object before the ICA.
Okay.
It's before this court for the first time right now.
Sorry, I don't want to monopolize your time, but I just have one more question. If in Nesmith, it refers to Elliott and depends on Elliott, at least in part, for that statement I just read to you. Elliott preceded Nesmith, and Elliott says, if you don't allege a state of mind, then you do not, then it cannot reasonably be construed as an offense. So did this particular complaint, or this case, comply with Elliott?
The rule, it did not comply with, or Elliott seems to suggest that state of mind is an essential element, or however you want to, a jurisdictional defect. I would like to point out where the words reasonably construed to be, reasonably be construed to charge a crime come from. They obviously come from Mott, right? And they're a direct quote from a case called United States versus Thompson. The site for that is 356 Federal 2nd at 226. Okay? I'm assuming that the Mott court knew what the facts of Thompson were. The facts in Thompson were that the charge in that case simply stated, you, Thompson, were charged with entering the First National Bank of Windsor Locks in Thompsonville, Connecticut, which was insured by the FDIC, with intent to commit in such bank a felony affecting such bank, that is, the taking of money in excess of $100 from said bank. Now, does that charge not, that charge does not state a crime, because it's not, it's obviously, it's not a crime to go into a bank and take $100, okay? What the charge admitted in that state was, what the charge admitted in that case was, with intent to steal or purloin. So in that case, both the government and the court agreed that the intent to steal was, as they termed it, under federal law, an essential element. But they said that it can, within reason, be construed to charge a crime. They reviewed it for plain error, they subjected it to plain error analysis, and they found that the defendant had not shown prejudice, and they affirmed the conviction. And I think that case is clearly in tension with Elliott's with regret.
Are you saying that Thompson required prejudice?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
But this court, in apparently referring to Mata, said that either the defendant has to show prejudice or that there's a failure to basically state an offense.
Right. The charge of crime language can be construed to charge of crime.
Cannot be construed to charge of crime, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Now, interesting thing about Elliott is, if you look at the section where, this is public quoted from, it refers to a case called Faulkner. Okay. Faulkner, in turn, refers back to a case called Genders. Okay? Neither of them Neither of them give much independent rationale for why state of mind is in a jurisdictional defect. Okay? They just go back to Gendrich. Gendrich does not stand for the proposition that state of mind is a jurisdictional defect. In that case, the mistake let me just tell you how the crime was charged. Okay, you Gendrich, with intent to cause public inconvenience, annoyance or alarm by members of the public, or recklessly creating the risk thereof, you did make unreasonable noise, etc. Okay. Now that was defective because the statute reads that you have to commit it with intent to cause physical inconvenience or alarm by a member of the family, or recklessly creating risk thereof. So clearly in Gendrich, the state of mind was stated, if intentionally or recklessly. The problem was with Gendrich is that the result of conduct was not properly stated. So we think that Elliott and Faulkner and the other case, Yonaha, all are based on somewhat a false premise that was originally, I think, as a misinterpretation of Gendrich. We think that MATA should be interpreted in the light of the cases it looked at when it adopted this rule from the federal courts.
And you didn't cross appeal or take a cross application from the finding of the ICA that there was an error in allowing the HGN evidence in because there was a lack of foundation.
We did not, Your Honor.
So then you're bound by that.
I'm bound by that.
Okay. So the only question left, if we go to the merits, is whether or not that was harmless error or not. The ICA being split on that. So assuming there are, I guess, because if you're bound by that, I guess there are three options, open or left, right? Well, we can affirm, or and that's the end of it, or we remand on the merits, and you have to retry the case. Is that right?
Retry the case, that's first.
Because if we say, well, no, we would reverse if we said, we agreed with the dissent and said it was harmful error, so we would reverse.
We would vacate.
If there wasn't vacate and
if
remand.
There wasn't sufficient evidence, it would be reversed. If there
I stand was. Corrected, Your Honor. Okay, so we reverse, you would try it again.
That's correct.
If we say there's no jurisdiction, you can refile and try again.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Under there's a case called, I think, Territory versus Barnum, I believe.
I think that Smith also sort of indicates that, but okay. Just wanted to confirm that with you.
Did you have any other questions about the HGM since you brought that up? I mean, facts are there. The only thing that the ICA didn't specifically address was, which I didn't notice and I thought was probative, is the fact that when they told her to keep her head still during the HGM test, she couldn't keep her head. She failed to follow instructions. Okay, and I think that independently, the HGM is a sign of impairment. She was aggressive, and there was a couple of examples in the case of how she was aggressive, verbally aggressive to the officer. And we think that presents a lack of judgment. And in short, we just believe that there's overwhelming evidence that she was driving badly. We believe she was driving badly. There's overwhelming evidence of impairment in motor skills, judgment, and perception. Did you have any more questions on the charging issue? One last thing. I think Chief Justice makes an excellent point. If this cannot be waived, if it's a nullity, I don't have an answer to your question as to what's going to happen when it comes up on a Rule 40 petition. I don't know. At this point, I'm not arguing that case, but I'm not sure if there's a clear distinction between finally refusing to allow the defendant to waive action here.
Well, all these cases saying that there wasn't a sufficient allegation have all resulted in dismissals without prejudice, haven't they?
If it was raised under Rule 40, theoretically, it would every conviction that's ever been, involved a charge that didn't have the state in mind in it, going back 30, 40 years, would theoretically have to be reversed. Or not reversed, but vacated. And we'd have to retry them, and these officers aren't here anymore for those cases. Many of them aren't.
So would that be the position of your office?
If another attorney, if one of my fellow colleagues comes here and thinks he can make a distinction between this case and a Rule 40 case, I have more power to him. I'm concerned. Okay, we're concerned.
So the state's position is it's not necessary to allege state of mind to establish jurisdiction.
That's
is that
correct.
Okay? What does have to be alleged to establish jurisdiction in the state's view?
Enough to let the judge, and this I think should be viewed from the point of view of the judge, okay, the judge who knows the law, okay, who's in this case a judge who's literally tried hundreds of ODUI cases.
Well, we might as well chuck Nesmith and everything else because we assume the judge knows the law. So if all the measure is the judge knows the law, it would never be any error.
Yeah, we're not talking about constitutional right. We're talking about jurisdictional.
Well, I'm talking about jurisdictional too, because the jurisdiction hinges on a constitutional right.
Yeah, theoretically, I think that even if the judge knows before trial what the charge is.
But if you take the position that you don't need to allege a state of mind A1 charge, aren't you butting heads with a statement out of Nesmith that you must allege mens rea in an A1 charge?
Pardon? I had a temporary.
Are you suggesting that most of the OBUII convictions are A1 charges rather than A3 charges?
Well, not all of them. There are a significant number of A1 charges.
The scenario you raise is actually not as dire as you suggest, correct?
I think.
Because Nesmith did hold that mens rea is not required for an A3.
The problem is we have a case called Wheeler in 2010. These cases. I mean, I would mean that. I mean, theoretically, before 2002, public road or highway wasn't required, right? But that would raise the issue of whether or not all those are subject to.
So have you been inundated on Rule 40 cases for the failure to allege public road?
We have one that's been decided by the ICA.
One since when?
But that I guarantee that will open the floodgates. Okay. If the defense bar believes that they can do that, okay, that there will be more coming. Believe me.
So, the precedent's already been set.
Well, the ICA has found that. Dickey State, okay? It's an SDO.
Well, all of this is a lot of speculation and hypothetical about things that may not happen.
I believe that you'll be presented with that issue shortly.
Anything else on the charging?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure you answered my question. What, in the view of the state, is required for what does the state have to allege to establish jurisdiction? If not every element and state of mind, what does the state have to allege in the view of in the charging document to establish the jurisdiction of the court?
The federal courts have interpreted jurisdiction. Well, there's a case called United States versus Cotton, which seems to do away with the jurisdictional requirement altogether. Okay, but even before Cotton, courts were very liberal with respect to interpreting a charge to state a crime, okay? They would allow statutory reference to cure a defect, and I would assume that in a case like this, they would allow the default state of mind stated by 702205 to cure a defect. I mean, this is what McDowell said, and I understand that McDowell has been overturned by Nesmith with respect to whether or not we have to state it in the charge, you know, and whether or not it's subject to automatic vacation if it's objected to before trial. But by the way, McDowell was decided about the same time as Mata was decided. So clearly, McDowell and this court, at least in 1983, did not believe that it was a jurisdictional defect at that point.
What about in Nesmith?
I think as counsel has represented, it was not decided in Nesmith. I think that your view on your take on it is very clear, and I think what I see is your take on it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but your take is that fair notice is almost coextensive with jurisdictional, okay, and that basically does away with the Mata Wells rule, in my opinion.
No, it doesn't do away with Mata.
At least that liberal construction is almost coextensive with the fair notice requirements of a charge. So,
you know, Mr. Vincent, you're advocating that we adopt the U.S. Supreme Court's position in Cotton. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not advocating that you adopt it.
Then why did you cite it in appendix?
I would say that in this case, and
no. Why did you cite it and append it to your?
I think that sooner or later this court may reevaluate its jurisdictional jurisprudence in this respect.
And this is for later on and not for this case.
It's for this case, but I think that there's a couple of cases that have cited Cotton, a couple of Ninth Circuit cases, where the issue was state of mind. Okay, and although the Ninth Circuit has agreed that it was an essential element or a necessary element, they said that it could be fairly construed from the statutory reference in that case. And the fact that it was at trial proved that he had the state of mind. There was no allegations of prejudice in this case, in those two cases. You want to put those two cases?
Well, the reason you cite Cotton is you say it does away with ex parte Bain, is that correct?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And in Goto, this court had cited ex parte Bain.
And I think primarily relied on ex parte
Bain. But I didn't primarily rely on that. But
well, there's three cases cited. Two of the cases refer to ex parte Bain.
So in Nesmith, though, the majority apparently sided with approval to Goto. So despite the fact that Cotton went one way. I think this court cited Goto with approval in Nesmith, saying, you know, quoting that part that said, if you don't allege an essential element, then you don't have jurisdiction.
That's correct. Both the majority and the dissent quoted Goto.
Right. So that in Nesmith, this court reaffirmed the relevance and precedent in Goto.
That's correct.
That would be contrary.
They rely on it. Yes.
That would be contrary to Cotton.
That's correct. We didn't quote Cotton in that case. This is as far as I know the first time Cotton has been quoted to this court, except for in a dissent by Chief Justice Nakamura in that case called State v. Johnson. Which was, I believe, overruled on other grounds.
There's another problem with Cotton, because Cotton says you have to allege the fact that would result in an extended term sentence.
That's correct.
In the complaint, in the indictment, mm-hmm. because you're looking at the Fifth Amendment, which doesn't bind us, but binds the federal government mm-hmm. with respect to indictments. But they said, well, we're going to apply a plain error rule to this indictment. and applying plain error, we don't see any problem. So they didn't take a jurisdictional point of view. They said, hey, we just apply plain error, and so we'll uphold the indictment even though it failed to allege the essential element that would result or would expose the defendant to an extended term sentence.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
You know, and just, I think this court took the opposite point of view. Because in Jess, we said, if you are going to give an extended sentence, then you must allege the conduct that would result in an extended term sentence, applying Apprendi.
This court said,
we make that prospective. Because if we don't make it prospective, we're going to be faced with a whole lot of Rule 40 motions that say, hey, the law in this jurisdiction is that it's jurisdictional. Citing Cummings, you have to allege the essential element that would result in an extended sentence. And if you don't, then you're out. Citing Cummings, so that in this jurisdiction, as opposed to Cotton, if you don't allege the conduct which exposes the defendant to an extended sentence, you're out. We don't apply a plain error rule.
This is a problem, I think. This is a problem with this jurisdictional construct idea.
I'm not sure if it's a problem.
I'm just saying that if it's jurisdictional and the case is rendered a nullity because of this, how can it be applied prospectively? I mean, if it's a nullity, it's a nullity. And this court has a number of times, with respect to jurisdiction, has said a case is a nullity if the charge doesn't state all the elements or all the essential elements.
But we've gone over this about dismissal without prejudice. But that's why the court had just made it prospective.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so if the case is a nullity and the defendant's in custody, the court's taking action, people are being held pending trial, all those actions are being taken without authorization of law. Is that what the implication of this rule is?
Of the jurisdictional rule, the fact that
it
assumes that everything we've done from the time we filed the thing, the defective complaint is illegal.
Well, I don't want to get into extended discussion, but of course, in these extended term cases, we said, no, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Although the court said, hey, in Magatuega, you know, the statute's void ab initio, we've never applied it that way.
Cummings has some very clear language in it, and it's a little bit disturbing to us. This idea that it's void ab initio, it's as though it never was, it's a nullity. And I would ask you to maybe reconsider that with respect, especially to this case, the specific facts of this case. Are there any further questions?
No. Thank you very much, Mr. Vincent. Ms. Nakamura, your rebuttal.
About notice, and it is about due process. Contrary to what the prosecution is arguing, that perhaps these are more formal errors, or they are not ones addressing jurisdiction, they are, and it is highly problematic.
You know, the prosecution cites Chingaya, and in that case, I guess, the prosecution didn't allege a state of mind on a prostitution charge. So is there any problem with that? Even non-jurisdictional, is there a problem with that?
I believe it's a serious problem, and it goes to notice, and that's what Nesmith was decided on, notice and due process. And those are very important protections and rights that...
I think the ICA said, well, it's not jurisdictional. I think misreading what I said and taking what I said out of context. But even if putting that aside, and if I had more time, I'd get into that, but isn't it just an issue of whether or not the charge can reasonably be construed to charge an offense or the complaint. I mean, that's Elliot. Elliot says, hey, you don't want to allege a state of mind, then it doesn't reason, you cannot reasonably construe the charge to state an offense. So even if the ICA set aside the jurisdictional question, they were still faced with a question, a due process question, of whether you could construe that charge as an offense. And so if you reach in Guya, then it stands for the proposition that if you charge it a prostitution offense, you don't have to say it's, you know, you don't have to allege a state of mind.
That's right.
Is that correct? I mean,
that's the reading of Shenguya that I have, and that's why I think defense bar has a serious problem with the IC's interpretation of Nesmith, and that's why we're here. Nesmith was really clear in deciding the case on notice. Unfortunately, the prosecution, the defense bar, and perhaps even the ICA are still looking for guidance as to what this all means.
How can a court just say, you're guilty of this offense, without saying what the state of mind is? Because doesn't the state of mind determine whether there's sufficient evidence to convict?
That's true. And I think...
And if you don't set out a state of mind, how do you know what evidence is relevant to convict?
You don't.
Then how do you reach the result that ICA reached in Shingai?
I'm not sure. I quite agree with the ICA's analysis.
Well, does it matter whether there's an objection or not? In other words, there can be constitutional violations that are nevertheless waivable if the defendant doesn't object. And that's really what we're talking about here, because you acknowledged your client did not object. Is that correct?
That's correct. My client did not object at the time. However, it is this issue about the failure to state an offense is something that we cannot waive. It is serious and does have implications, very severe implications for ones of notice and the Constitution and protecting due process rights, which this court in our state has taken very seriously. And to hold otherwise would be contrary to this court's holdings, even post the Cotton case that the prosecution brought up. I believe in a number of these cases, the prosecution has argued that this is more, this is merely a defective form.
But you can't waive the challenge to the indictment even if at trial all the elements are set forth and the trier of fact is required to find all of the necessary elements of the offense?
Well, I would argue that if the mens rea is not alleged, the defendant or perhaps my client at the time wouldn't have full notice about what they're really being charged with. They get the piece of paper or they're orally read the charge or the indictment. However, if there's necessary things that are not alleged, like the mens rea, they're not fully informed about what they're even going to ask their defense counsel. You know, if those three words are included, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, that might pique the interest of the defendant to say, hey, you know, wait, what does that mean? Oh, wait, no, I didn't know that. I didn't know such and such was going on. And that could lead to a very, very winnable defense in that case. So we do argue that this is a question of jurisdiction.
That would be an argument for plain error review as opposed to it being jurisdictional. In other words, one might argue that this is such a fundamental affects such fundamental rights that it should be noticeable on plain error, but that's very distinct from saying it's a jurisdictional inquiry, isn't it?
Well, we do believe that it is jurisdictional. However, we do acknowledge that this court could rule on this case based on plain error. But we do hold, in light of Nesmith and the case law in Hawaii, including, and in particular, State versus Elliott, that this is a jurisdictional issue.
If this court does not recognize that it's jurisdictional or recognized plain error, what would preclude ineffective assistance of counsel claims for all of those defendants that were not advised as to the right to be informed of intent requirement?
Well, I would hope that defense counsel is advising their clients of the requisite mens rea. However, I guess such claims wouldn't be precluded because it would go to jurisdiction. It is fundamental. However, yeah, I don't know that would be something that would be problematic if it does, because it does go to serious rights that are implicated. So if I could wrap up, We do appreciate the court's time today and do ask that you vacate Ms. Avila's conviction based on the two grounds. The first being that the HGN test was not harmless in this instance, and two, because the court did lack jurisdiction based on Nesmith and the existing case law regarding the notice issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.